Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You're listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Today, we'll be talking Eat the City and upcoming food events. But first up, food headlines with Jack Inslee.
I really like being on this show every week.
Oh, you like this, Jack? Yeah. Oh.
I look forward to it now.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's really good. Like. You got some good headlines this week. So apparently there were some crazy lines for Pock Pock, which is in... I didn't even know this area. Columbia Street Waterfront District in Brooklyn.
The people say it's Red Hook.
I guess. Right. Down there and who knows where. Yeah. But yeah, there are people lined up way down the block. And I guess it kind of just raises the question, how long are you willing to wait to eat at a place, you know? How dedicated?
Yo, okay. So let me just say this. I had dinner at Pock Pock, I think, about a month ago, over a month ago. I waited like an hour and 20 minutes. Everyone that I talked to was like, oh, I waited like an hour and 30 minutes, almost 2 hours. So I'm like, is any restaurant really worth it? Would you wait that long, Jack?
Well, how was your meal at Pock Pock?
It was good.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I'm just going to keep it real and be real honest. It was not worth waiting an hour
right.
and a half.
That's kind of my position, too.
It was not. I mean, I hear, though, if you're listening and you want to go to Pock Pock, this is what I heard. If you go right at 6 o'clock when they open, there are no waits. And if you go right at, like, 10, I think they closed at, like, 11 or so, there's zero waits.
That's like what I tell people for Roberta's. You can't come here at 8 o'clock and expect to sit down.
And this is funny, hey, I get that all the time. People tell me all the time, oh my gosh, I went to Roberta's and the wait was an hour.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm here on Mondays.
Right, 3:30.
So if you're listening, you come to New York City or you already live here, you've never been to Roberta's and you don't want to wait.
Yeah, and come see
come
how
on
Grease
Mondays.
Happen live.
Exactly.
I don't know, I wouldn't wait. It's kind of, it reminds me of like when people wait in line for tickets to see a band. You know, they camp out in the street waiting for tickets. I guess some people are super dedicated.
Let me see if anybody... I put the question on Twitter. Did anybody say anything? No, no one said anything.
No one said anything. Okay. Well, we'll see. More concerning than that, it seems like grocery prices will be going up, according to the Consumer Price Index, about 4-5% in 2013. And this article doesn't really say why, but that's kind of not a good look.
Is it the drought? I hear it's like a drought, you know, everywhere.
Our guest is nodding her head, yes.
Oh, okay, so our guest, who we haven't introduced yet, that's why, 4-5%. So what does that mean, Jake?
Hey, I mean, I'll say this much. This is always what Patrick said. You know, I guess this just means now commodity groceries are just... It's to say good food is not that much more expensive when you think about a heritage pork chop or something like that, only being a few dollars, and now all these commodity grocery prices are going up and up and up and up. I mean,
because if you spend $100 on groceries per week, I'm just going to go up a little bit. I'm going to say that an extra $10. I mean, honestly, $10, if you're not buying, you know, meat, if you're buying other, that's a lot. I mean, that's some rice, dry beans.
Well, all the more reason maybe to look into a CSA share, too.
Or grow your own food.
Or grow your own food.
How about that?
And moving on now to your hometown, a lot of food trends to look out for in Atlanta. This one comes from the Atlanta Journal, I guess.
AJC, huh?
AJC, right.
It's like the New York Times.
I see. Yeah. So tell me what you think of these trends and if you've seen this happen. Well, first of all, a few new restaurants. Watershed on Peachtree and the new Richard Blaze restaurant with the Spence. Have you heard of these places?
Okay, so Watershed is like an old classic that moved to a new location.
Okay.
On Peachtree. Used to be the chef there, used to be Scott Peacock, for people who follow Southern chefs. So yeah. What are they saying about those in terms of the trends? Just new restaurants?
Yeah, just new spots to check out. And then as far as trends go, they're saying schnitzel is everywhere right now in Atlanta.
Oh, that is hilarious, yeah. Right? Because the first thing I think about is the schnitzel and things truck. There's a truck of in New York City, a street food truck.
Yeah, well, apparently it's popping up everywhere in Atlanta.
Interesting.
Chicken, skate wing, unusual schnitzel, scallop schnitzel. I didn't think that was a real
interesting
thing.
Okay,
that thing. So that's interesting. Next trend being the death of the entree. They're saying a lot of these restaurants now are just offering small, medium, and large plates and not really thinking of it in terms of an entree, you know.
So Atlanta is catching up with New York City,
right?
There you go. All right, ATL, you're catching up with New York City. Yeah, I mean, same with the food costs going up 4 or 5%. I totally see restaurants in Atlanta and elsewhere doing the same thing.
Mm. Speaking of New York trends in Atlanta, it's saying that all the Atlanta chefs love kale now.
Really?
That's what I'm reading here.
Kale is old news, right? But hey.
Well, I mean, on Heritage Radio, at least, it's old news.
I'm not mad. What are they doing? Did they say what chefs and what restaurants are doing?
Richard Blaze making a really good killer kale Caesar salad. Crew at Yeah Burger is serving theirs with balsamic vinaigrette and pine nuts. Craig Richards at Echo tosses it in his pasta. So,
okay.
Popping up everywhere. And Southern Farm to Table starting to become Southern Farm to Buford Highway to Table.
Oh, Buford Highway. That's a place for ethnic food all day long. All right. So people in Atlanta, mainstream people in Atlanta are picking up on the whole ethnic food craze. Because most people who are serious foodies, we already know Buford Highway is the place to go for ramen and all that good stuff. Now, now everyone else probably will go run in there. Interesting. Mm.
And the last item is that good wine lists are coming back. You know, there's been a big cocktail list craze, but apparently...
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wonk, wonk, wonk.
Yeah.
Really?
Atlanta food trends.
I thought... Okay, Atlanta. Really? You guys have places with...
We have to send you down to Atlanta. We need to get you actually there interviewing.
Yeah, we need to... I need to go totally go in there. You Richard did. Blaze, I met him last... I feel like he's been on a show...
Snacky Tunes, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. So if y'all want to hear Richard Blaze, we've never heard of him before. People know him from Top Chef. He's been on Heritage Radio Network on Snacky Tunes. Put his name in our box.
Yeah.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
What else is going on? You eat anything good lately?
Yo, the last week I've cooked. Last night I made garlic scape risotto cakes. I had garlic scapes in the freezer. And I was like, okay, I just need to get rid of this stuff. I was like, what can I make? I had risotto, put Greek yogurt in it, eggs, and Vermont sharp cheddar. And I made the risotto cakes. They were really freaking good. Put a little lemon juice on the top. So I've been cooking a lot at home, Jack.
Me too.
Oh, really?
Like first time in my life, yeah.
I've been like the whole entire week, so I haven't gone out to dinner maybe once last week.
I will say before the segment's up, I did go to Philly last night. And
Philly?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Randomly, totally randomly. So Jeff Gordier was on, he's a writer for the Times, he was on the food scene, and he had like really offhandedly mentioned, he's like, well, if you ask me, the best restaurant I ever ate at was Zahav in Philadelphia. So of course, I Google it, I look, it's, you know, priced well, it was a short drive, me and my girlfriend looking for somewhere to go.
Oh, wow.
Took the drive out, it was good.
What'd you have?
It was an Israeli restaurant, so there are all different hummuses and little small plates. And then they brought us, and once he found out I was with Heritage, they brought us out a lamb shoulder.
So what's the name of the spot again?
Zahav.
Zahav. Okay, I need to check them out.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out.
So if you live in Philly and you listen to the show, yeah, give us a thumbs up on Twitter or Facebook on Heritage Radio Network page or either Food Cultures. And let us know if you've been to Philly and checked out the Israeli restaurant Jack mentioned. Jack, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Food Headlines. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back next week with Jack and more Food Headlines. Keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Better Things by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Today we are talking Eat the City with Robin Shulman. She is the author of Eat the City, a tale of the fishers, foragers, butchers, farmers, poultry minders, sugar refiners, cane cutters, beekeepers, and winemakers and brewers who built New York City. Robin!
Hello.
Welcome to Hot Grease.
Thank you so much.
So glad to have you on the show. Gorgeous new book. It's out in stores everywhere. I have to ask you first. I know we've talked about this a few times here on the show. New York being the center of the food world. Do you see that in the media now? And sometimes the media can depict New York in kind of a snarky way. How do you feel about it? What do you think about that?
I'm not sure if New York is actually the center of this kind of food world, but it sometimes seems as though it is because there's so much media here writing about it that it broadcast everywhere. But, you know, there's so much going on in places like Atlanta, where I was earlier in the week.
So funny, we talked about Atlanta earlier.
Yeah, we talked about Atlanta. There's a lot going on there, and you're saying it's a lot changed just in the past 4 years. Out on the West Coast, obviously, they've been doing this for a really long time. So food production is something that's being talked about a lot in New York. I'm not sure it's actually happening so much more than everywhere else.
So it's good to know that it keeps us humble. We're not the center of the food world.
Maybe we're not the center.
So you moved to New York City in 1993. What do you remember about food and people producing food and fishers and all that good stuff when you moved here from, I think, Canada, right?
I actually was living out in California. I moved here in 92 to go to college.
Okay.
And that first summer, after my first year of college, I found myself living over the summer downtown in Manhattan on the Lower East Side. And I was living in this neighborhood that at that time was pretty violent. There were sometimes gunshots almost every night outside my door. And there was a lot of drug trade happening. And in right next to my building, there were 12 adjacent vacant lots. And people would just go in and, you know, I would glance out my window and see people trading plastic baggies for wads of cash and then falling asleep in the trash. So it was a pretty desolate place in some ways. But pretty soon after I got there, I saw that my neighbors were trying to clean up the place. So I went down and I saw that people were shoveling up syringes into big garbage bags, and I helped out a bit. And a few months later, people started planting things. So there were all kinds of vegetables and herbs, and people brought in roosters. So I was waking up to a rooster crowing, and the roosters kind of made a racket. They were city roosters who were distracted by headlights passing by, thinking it was the sun coming up. So I noticed when suddenly they were quiet, and I asked my neighbor, my seven-year-old neighbor, Carolina, what happened to the rooster? And she said, my dad made chicken soup. So I kind of slowly started realizing that this garden that was really transforming my block and other gardens that were springing up all over the neighborhood were coming into existence, not just because people wanted to create something pretty, but because people actually wanted to produce food. So I started thinking more about how that can change a place.
And this was in 1992.
Yeah, in the very early 90s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's go back 100 years to like 1912. What did New York City look like in terms of the tales of folks, all these different folks that you mentioned in the book? What did it look like? What could one expect if they walked down to the Lower East Side or even all the way up to Midtown or Upper Manhattan?
Well, 1912, I think, was really already an era of transition. Most of the farms in the city had already been built up into buildings. So farmland had really been phased out. But still, in places in Manhattan, in Upper Manhattan, there were still big farms. And there were places where there was a big farm and surrounded by tall apartment buildings, and people in the apartments could kind of go down and buy milk from the farmer or eggs or get their vegetables there. So the farms were still in the middle of the city and supplying the city. There was a big brewery on the Upper East Side. There were still breweries all over Brooklyn and the Bronx, Queens. The brewery on the Upper East Side was owned by a man named Jacob Rupert, who soon after 1912, a little bit later than what we're talking about, he actually bought the New York Yankees.
Oh, wow.
And he was a big real estate owner and kind of the big man in the neighborhood. The brewery guys were always the big men in the neighborhood. They owned a lot of real estate and had a lot of jobs. There were still a lot of wineries all over town. There was a lot of kosher winemaking down on the Lower East Side, which would soon expand because of prohibition. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot more people interested in buying kosher wine and in making it, whether or not they were actually Jewish or using it for sacramental purposes, which was exempt from prohibition. There were a lot of neighborhood butchers. Many neighborhoods had a butcher on every block. The largest meat packing district on the East Coast was forming on around 14th Street. There were still slaughterhouses operating in Midtown.
Meat packing district.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reason it has that name. The Midtown slaughterhouses had cows walking through the streets to be slaughtered on the West Side. So it was a very different city than it is now.
Yes, it totally is. We're actually going to take a short break and come back. We're going to get more into Eat the City with Robin. Keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
You used to run when you raised your hand. She ain't a child no more.
She ain't a child no more.
She was too young then to understand. She ain't a child no more.
You're listening to She Ain't a Child No More by Sharon Jones of the Dap Kings.
Came home drunk in the middle of the night, screaming and swinging with all of your might. But a child couldn't put up a fight. She ain't a child no more.
She ain't a child no more.
Poor little girl.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. You can check our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.org. We are chatting with Robin Shulman. She's a writer, reporter, and her most recent work is Eat in the City, published by Crown. So, Robin, what I love about this book, I'm a sucker for a good illustration. And at the very beginning of the book, actually the outside cover is like wrapped in this great map of New York City, but in the inside is this pictorial map of like all the stories that you're telling inside of the book. And I would say I have to tell folks that the stories have a deep historical account, but it's not like an academic type book. You read it, you feel like you're reading a long newspaper article, probably because you're a journalist, huh?
Something like that.
How did you come up with the idea of doing this map and then kind of depicting, you know, different stories in different boroughs? Because you have something, a story about Staten Island in here, several about Brooklyn and Manhattan, Queens, and so forth.
I think it was pretty clear to me early on that I wanted to do this map because, for me, writing this book really transformed the way I saw the city. You know, I would go through places I passed through all the time in the city, and suddenly I would know more about their past and know more about what was going on behind closed doors in the present. And so I really wanted to depict that for other people so they could, at a glance, kind of take in a city they may not have known was there. And so I knew that I wanted to create a map.
So one of my favorite stories in the entire book, and I feel like Grist actually wrote about it as well last week, Twilight. What's her name?
Twilight Greenway.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, Twilight Greenway. She's a food editor for Grist. But she mentioned in this, and then I'd already read it, the Willie Morgan's Garden, which is in Harlem. Please quickly tell folks the story, because I think it's a beautiful story that captures the great migration and people moving from the South to the North.
Yeah, I love Willie's story, too. He told me his life story and how he came to be growing vegetables in Harlem when I met him. He actually grew up in Georgia in the home of his grandparents, who were sharecroppers. And so they knew how to grow pretty much everything they needed to eat. They kept pigs. They went hunting. They went fishing. So they really were able to sustain themselves on what they were able to raise and live on. So he moved to New York City with his parents when he was 9 years old. And at the time in the 40s, New York City was, and specifically Harlem, was incredibly crowded. One block of Harlem was one of the most crowded in the entire country. And there wasn't a lot of space to grow things. But Willie was part of this generation of African Americans that came from the rural South and moved to the urban North in the cities. And they had skills for farming. And for a lot of people, it was the first time that they had ever actually had to buy their food instead of grow it on their own. So people figured out ways to grow. I mean, some people were growing plants, beans and peas in soap boxes on their fire escapes, and people made roof gardens, and people were really ingenious in figuring out spaces and ways to produce things. But Willie didn't grow yet. He was an adult with his own profession before he decided he needed to grow things. In fact, he had a numbers joint, and
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so he was actually running this numbers business, and he decided that if he set up his shop to look like a greengrocer, then the cops would never cotton on to the fact that he was actually running an illegal gambling operation. And he went down and got a license from the Department of Consumer Affairs, and he had this vision for stacking vegetables all around the shelves, and he thought his customers would be more loyal to him than the other numbers guy if he would give them free vegetables once a week. But he didn't have any vegetables, so he decided to grow them in a vacant lot next to his storefront. But it's actually a larger story, because at that time in the 60s, this was 1969, Harlem was really changing, and other neighborhoods in the city were changing too. Buildings were coming down and burning down and being demolished because they'd been so neglected, and it was creating all this space. And people like Willie Morgan took that as an opportunity to put into action the skills they'd grown up with and to really plant the city with food.
I love that story. That story is it's brilliant. Another thing, you have a whole entire chapter in this book titled Sugar. And I was sitting there like, sugar in New York City? Oh, really? And then I thought about it. I was like, I guess most people don't think about sugar cane and sugar in New York City.
I really didn't know very much about it myself until I began this research, and then I found it astonishing. I met a man in the Bronx named Jorge Torres, who is actually growing sugar cane in the Bronx.
Right now? Today?
Today.
Oh, interesting.
He has the cane plant right now. I'm not sure if it's totally ripe yet, but in a little bit, we'll be able to watch him go with his machete and harvest it. But I was really impressed that he could grow it, because New York City, although it's been hot, is not a tropical climate. Uh-uh. But he nurtures the sugar cane plants on his windowsill in the spring, and then he goes and plants them in the garden, and they grow.
And a bigger thing that you kind of explored in this chapter is the history of sugar and the trading of sugar. And actually, New York City, correct me if I'm wrong, was like the largest importer exporter of sugar cane in the entire country. Is that right?
It's right. You know, I loved Jorge's story, because to me, his story told the history of sugar in the city as well. He's from Puerto Rico, and he grew up harvesting sugar cane on a cane plantation when he was a child. And in fact, New York has this long connection with Caribbean sugar plants. When the Dutch founded New York City in the 1600s, sugar was rising as a global commodity, and the Dutch ended up trading away Manhattan to the British in exchange for Suriname, because on Suriname they could plant sugar, which they thought would be far more valuable than Manhattan Island. They might have been wrong. In the 1700s, sugar really became as valuable as gold and oil were to other eras. And at that time, New York City had sugar refining was the leading industry in New York City. And so the wealth from refining that sugar really brought New York to the world stage. New York became a global city at that time. But at the same time, the sugar was coming from the Caribbean, where it was being harvested by enslaved Africans. So there's always been, from the very beginning, this intimate connection between New York City's growth and wealth and this very dark Caribbean history. Then in the 1800s, all the refineries moved to the Brooklyn waterfront, and Brooklyn produced most of the sugar in the country.
Amazing. And
they invested that money in banks, including Citibank, what we know today as Citibank. Ah. So it's kind of an incredible story of the way that sugar helped build this town.
And lastly, I want to talk about, I mean, you have how many chapters in this book? I mean, covering everything from meat to beer, to wine. But what I find most fascinating, and it's been in the news so much, and I feel like there's an entire book that's about oysters in New York City. Just briefly tell us about this history of oysters and fishery in New York City.
Well, there is a book. It's by Mark Kurlansky, The Big Oyster.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's great. And so I didn't really want to rewrite that book, so I didn't focus on oysters in my chapter on fishing, but the story of oysters is really fascinating. Oysters were a major industry in New York City, and the city was known for them. Like, if people were visiting New York from other places, their friends would tell them, enjoy the oysters. You could get, for 6 cents, you could get all the oysters you can eat. And they came from oyster beds with name. They were named Rockaways or other names of local waters for after the beds they came from.
So let me ask you this. The decline of oysters and the decline of the whole fishing industry in New York City, are they linked?
They are, and it's all about pollution.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's partly about overfishing, but it's also the story of pollution. New York was such an industrial city, and essentially it used its waterways as trash dumps. And there was a time in the early 1900s when there were so many oil refineries spilling so much oil into the water that the actual water would catch fire, and people describe these kind of rolling waves of flame coming in onto Staten Island or onto Newtown Creek. So the water was incredibly polluted with oil. It was also polluted with sewage. There was a time when people were actually getting typhoid just by handling oil, just by handling the oysters, and typhoid is a disease transmitted from being in contact with sewage. So people said at a certain point you could tell which bed an oyster was from by its petroleum flavor. So after a certain point, nobody wanted to eat the oysters harvested from the city's waters.
There you have it. We're going to actually take a short break. We're going to come back. Robin's going to give you all the deets on where to find her. And she's been all over the country and all over New York City doing event book events. So keep listening. We'll be back in a sec.
Ain't nothing evil about money.
You're listening to Money by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
President's scratching his head. The economy is down. Wall Street about to lose him. I'm up and down.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Hot Grease is produced by myself and Jack Inslee, and we're being engineered today by Joe G. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York, the location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. We are finishing our discussion with Robin Schulman. She's the author of Eat in the City. We just had a very fascinating, we could actually talk all day long about the history. I find it so fascinating, and it definitely gives me, and I'm sure the listeners who are doing food stuff or interested in food stuff, gives you a great foundation just to look at the historical standpoint of really entrepreneurs and the spirit of New Yorkers surviving and making a living. Where else will you be in the next few months talking about this book?
Well, I'll be traveling to Montreal next.
Oh!
Yeah, which I'm excited about. It's a good foodie city.
Yes, love Montreal.
Yeah, then I'm heading to the West Coast. So I'm going to be in LA and San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver.
All right, spreading the love, huh? And if folks want to find you, how can folks find you online?
You can go to my website, which is www.robinschulman.com.
And you're on Twitter, same name.
It's true, Robin Schulman on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I think anyone who's serious about food, you need this book. I'm not just saying this just to be saying it, but you really do. Also, too, before we head out on Hot Grease, I just want to tell you about two upcoming events here in New York City. The summer is winding down. Can you believe it? We're almost done with the summer. So September 15th, my buddies over at the Street Vendor Project are doing the Vendy Awards. They're happening at Governor's Island. And I think tickets are still available. So go to their website, buy a ticket. And Food Systems Network NYC on August 26th, which is a Sunday, they're doing the Tomato Fest and the Great Tomato Uncook-Off. It's going to be at New Amsterdam Market, so check them out as well. Two food events right here in New York City. If you're here in the city or if you're traveling, check them out. Robin, thank you so much for being on Hot Grease. Listeners, thank you for listening. Remember, you can join me here every Monday at 3:30 Eastern Time. But until then, always take the road less traveled.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.